Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Gerard Lobo and Morgan de Togny. We review Honeymoon in Vegas. Peter comes back to tell us about Constellations and Nevermore, as well as a report from the Junior Theater Festival in Atlanta. We talk a little bit about Neverland, the upcoming musical, and also we have trivia answers and the new trivia question for the week. Please stay tuned. And look what I found. I like dancing on the pier. I like Broadway once a year, but I love Betsy. I like visits to the zoo. I like opera. That's not true, but I love Betsy. It's been 5 years and I'm ready. Get the sparklers and confetti. Give a wink to the waiter and summon the maitre d'. Just like Jay-Z and Beyonce, I will make her my fiancé. I love Betsy. I love Betsy. I love Betsy. And Betsy loves me. Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, January 25th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His new one is The Great Parade, to be released April 7th and available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome back from your trip to Atlanta. Tell us about what you did.
Yeah, I was at the Junior Theater Festival, which really every teacher who teaches drama or even has a brush with it should know about, because troops of kids from 27 states, the District of Columbia, Australia, and South Korea came to the Renaissance Waverly Hotel in Atlanta to perform 15-minute excerpts from the musicals they either had done in the fall or will do in the spring. What, of course, interested me most was how many people were doing Into the Woods Junior, because when I did the first edition of my book, Let's Put on a Musical, I remember getting a review from someone saying, I don't know why he's recommending Into the Woods for children, because they could never possibly do it. Well, yes, they can. In fact, Music Theater International has 246 upcoming productions of Into the Woods Junior, and the kids were marvelous in that and everything else, and it's so wonderful to see kids so interested in musical theater, doing shows as old as The Pirates of Penzance dance and as recently as recent shows as The Little Mermaid, so, and everything in between. There's certainly a lot of non-traditional casting. I saw a very thin Tracy Turnblad. I saw a very feminine Edna Turnblad. So it doesn't matter. This is educational. It's all about getting the kids out there performing. And it's so wonderful to see their faces when the judges after the show tell them so many wonderful things that they've done, to have it validated. They knew they were good, but to have somebody else say it is really terrific. And who knows how many friendships, relationships will emerge from all this. 4,500 kids were there. It was the 10th anniversary of the festival, which started with 650 kids. It always grows. And what was really nice is that Benj Pasek and Justin Paul were there, and so were Bobby Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez, where the kids, of course, went crazy over them, because every one of them knew every lyric from Frozen, as they proved when Bobby and Kristen performed, and of course they sang along with every syllable. So it's quite a thing, and really teachers, find out about this. Don't let this pass you by. You have a whole year to plan for it and raise money to get your kids there. But if kids from South Korea and Australia can get there, so can you. So make it happen.
That's so great to hear, Peter. It as we talk about so often, it's so important to offer children outlets in many different ways to express themselves artistically. Mm-hmm. And this is just one incredible way. Also with us this morning is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. After we talk today, I'm going to Staten Island to rehearse for a Valentine cabaret that I'm going to be singing in on February 15th at St. George Theater, which is most recently famous as one of the location sites for the shooting of Smash.
Yeah, that's right.
So maybe I'll see if the the vibes of Megan Hilty or whoever is still running around in the theater.
By the way, Megan Hilty was also at the Junior Theater Festival. She did a concert the final night. So Megan's name is coming up. Michael, now I know very little about Staten Island, but as I recall, St. George is near the ferry, so it's not going to be hard to get to.
Oh yeah, it's like five minute walk.
Okay, good.
Uphill, yeah.
Will they record it?
Will they? Will who? I don't know. I hope not.
Yeah, now that Gotthard Liebesen is dead, you know. I mean, yeah. So.
Yeah, it'll be a limited edition.
Right.
But boy, Peter, having Bobby and Kristen Lopez at that event and performing that song—that must have been like, you know, going to a Christian convention and having the person who wrote Ave Maria.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That must have been so thrilled.
What's also nice is they brought Luca Padovan, who was the little boy in Newsies towards the end of the run, and Lila Crawford played Little Red Riding Hood in the Into the Woods movie and was Annie on Broadway. And it's so great to have little kids and then a teenager there, because it really inspires the kids. If they can do it, I can do it.
Yes.
And that's what's so important as well.
With us this morning, we have a very special pair of guests. Gerard Lobo and Morgan DeTagni are with us. They are from the Hypocrite Theater Company, and they have a production of Romeo and Juliet that's running February 6th to February 22nd down at the Axis Theater on 380 Broadway. Gerard, Morgan, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Thanks for having
We're
us,
so
guys.
Happy to be here.
So tell us, you know, we were talking a few weeks ago about this onslaught of Romeo and Juliets that have come to New York. Why do you have this feeling that you should do another production of Romeo and Juliet?
Well, we can thank our co-founder and artistic director, Arpita Mukherjee, for that. She is from Delhi, and it has been her dream to do Romeo and Juliet with a Bollywood aesthetic. So when they started Hypocrite Theater Company and they were throwing around ideas for what their first production was going to be, that's sort of what she was pushing. And that's the difference about it. It's going to be done with a Bollywood aesthetic.
What does that really mean? Tell us, if you can, over the radio. I don't know if you can.
Yeah. No, definitely.
That's
a really good question. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of elements to it, but all in all, if you've ever watched a Bollywood movie, one of the main things are the music, the dreamscapes, the costumes, the love triangles, and that's basically all going to be in the play. It's like watching a Bollywood movie that's going to be on stage.
Now,
in Shakespearean verse.
Have you guys had any experience in the Bollywood world, or are you fans of it before this?
For me, this was my first experience, my first introduction to Bollywood. But it has been a very exciting ride. We got to watch a lot of Bollywood films. And so basically, I have a background in musical theater, so it reminds me a lot of musical theater with all the dancing and song kind of put into these dramatic storylines. So it's been really fun for me.
It's also been said that many times actors have told me that doing Shakespeare is not unlike doing a musical because the language is musical in itself. Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, you know, I haven't done a ton of Shakespeare. I studied it in school a little bit, but I found myself really taking to the language and the kind of the melody of the lines. It's been kind of a nice, fun transition for me. I can't speak for people who don't have musical theater background. I'm sure Gerard could shed a little more light about how it's been for him. But yeah, I have noticed that it does remind me of musical theater a little bit.
In fact, have you played that Juliet type role of Maria in West Side Story?
I have not, but actually this is kind of funny. My mom runs a children's theater workshop for kids in Chicago, and so I think I played Maria when I was like 10. It seems inappropriate, but like an abridged version. So I think I was Maria 2 in the second act, but nothing like what I'm doing now.
Okay. Well, I have a related question. I saw Gerard and Morgan about a year ago in a production of Lilium.
Yeah, in
which they played Lilium and Julie. And I was wondering if either of you have played have done the equivalent roles in the musical.
In Carousel?
Yeah.
I have not. Have you, Morgan?
No, I never played Julie. However, I would love to sometime.
It's still time. Where does the name of the company come from?
Hypocrite. Hypocrite is an ancient Greek word that basically means to pretend. And since they're going to be reviving a lot of classical works with a multicultural cast, they figured, why not go with the Greek word?
It is attention getting. Notice I asked the question.
Right? So, it's a little bit like, wait, hypocrite.
Yeah.
So the on your website at Hypocrite NYC, HYPOKRITNYC.org, talk about the what we call the bullet for Romeo and Juliet is the world's greatest love story. William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet comes alive at Axis Theater with a Bollywood twist, complete with music, dance, love triangles, and fight sequences. The classic tale will be told in verse, but set in a vibrant city of Delhi, performed by two stellar casts and rep.
Oh.
Directed by, please help me with the name of the director.
Arpita Mukherjee.
I was going to say that. And it was produced by Arpita and who?
Shubhra Prakash.
I was going to say that too. Okay.
I call them the wrong names all the time as well.
So you guys, so
they're very close friends of mine.
You have two casts here in rep. So are you spanning both casts, or are you in? It looks like you're in cast one.
That's right. We're in the main cast, and the reason why Arpita wanted to do cast is this is their inaugural production. They just wanted to get as much talent as possible involved in the production. And strangely, I don't know how she did this, but she's basically like they're two completely different shows. They both have a Bollywood aesthetic, but I guess in the second cast, the Romeo and Juliet is more of the sort of classical story of innocence, where in the main cast, it much more sort of accentuates the environment in Delhi of like violence and wealth and power. And Romeo and Juliet are, you know, sort of an age range that Morgan and I are in, mid-20s, early-30s kind of thing. And it's not really about innocence. It's more about sort of passion and wealth and power and things like that.
So Gerard, Lilium, and now this, are you getting typecast as evil?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, Romeo's not such an evil guy. I guess he's a little machismo the way we're playing him, but it's kind of interesting. Lilium was like sort of a dark, twisted Romeo and Juliet. And I guess, you know, maybe getting typecasted for guys forlorn in love with where things don't work out.
So along with the two different casts, you have a list of dancers that are in this as well that are separated out in the old tradition of musical theater, a whole dancing chorus of 14, 15 or so people. This sounds like a very big, elaborate production.
Oh, it's going to be a sort of in-your-face production. I mean, the Access Theater is an intimate 50-seat theater, and just the dance troupe alone, I mean, we got to get a little glimpse of it when we were having our run-throughs. The main dancer in it that sort of has a solo in the production, she won So You Think You Can Dance India. And I came over here, I think, a couple of years ago, and so she sort of, Arpita put together the choreography, but she's sort of leading all the individual numbers kind of thing, and it's, we had our launch party the other day at Prana, and she sort of put on a show for everyone there watching while we're giving a little sneak peek of the show. I mean, Morgan, you want to chime in? I thought she was pretty amazing.
Yeah, she's incredible. It'll be really fun too, because they're opening the show. They come into the ball, so it does kind of bring in that Bollywood feel of that team of dancers doing this really elaborate, amazing dance. It's really cool.
And aside from the multicultural aspect of the cast, there's also some interesting gender-blind casting. You have, let's see, in the main cast you have Shubhra Prakash as Mercutio, a lady named Shubhra Prakash. And then in the second cast, you have Nikita Chowdhury as Benvolio.
Right.
And I think there are a few other acts. So it's just really hitting all bases here. It's really
interesting.
It's kind of interesting,
cool.
yeah.
With our cast, with Shubhra playing Mercutio, she it kind of plays on that Bollywood love triangle of the best friend that's in love with the main guy, and then also, but he loves another girl. So it's a cool dynamic, and then that changes completely in the second cast, which also goes along with what Gerard was saying before about how different the casts are just based on those relationships alone.
Well, I just saw that, as I mentioned to you guys, the Shakespeare in the Square production, and it is interesting how much you can play up or not the idea that Mercutio maybe is in love with Romeo, and not
right.
Obviously not changing any lines, but just hit, you know, the way that they're delivered and the chemistry. You know, it's really that's always fascinated me.
That's the amazing thing. I mean, the fact that Arpita was sort of able to see this with the love triangles, and you really don't have to change the verse, and it works.
Mm.
I'm also reading on your site that there is no late seating, and plan to arrive at least 30 minutes before the showtime.
Wow.
Is there something special that we should know about pre-show?
Yeah, because those dancers that we just referenced are going to be putting on a spectacle. So in order for that not to be interrupted, they're asking people to be seated by 7:30. And in the lobby, there's drinks, and they're going to have the whole lobby decked out in sort of a deli atmosphere. So there are, you know, things to look at and do before if you get there early. So they do ask that people get there by 7:30.
You should imply that it includes lap dancing, and then you'll get people.
Wait, I just bought some tickets. So, all right. Well, tell us, Gerard, start us off, and then we'll get to Morgan next. Where are you from?
I was actually born in Karachi, Pakistan, and moved here to the United States in New Jersey when I was turning 6 years old. My family, my ancestry comes from a place in India called Goa, hence the Lobo surname. Goa was settled by the Portuguese a long, long time ago, 600 years ago, and I guess a lot of people converted to Catholicism. And, you know, people have last names like Lobo, Fernandez, Diaz. So it's kind of interesting growing up here. I didn't really learn my native language, and I'm working on that now. But, you know, from Karachi and India with the last name Lobo, everyone's like, so what exactly are you? We own a lot of stuff. I guess ethnically, I would say I'm Indian.
And so you grew up in Jersey. How did you end up in theater?
So I grew up at the time, it was a small town where basically you either played sports or did nothing. So I grew
up
in Mahwah, New Jersey.
Well, we know Mahwah, sure.
Yeah,
train
nice.
Stops there.
That's right. Now,
on the way to Red Bank, we've stopped in Mahwah. Yeah.
There you go, yeah.
I've seen One Touch of Venus there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Daisy Gamble from On a Clear Day You Can See Forever originally came from Mahwah. They changed it to Rahway after the Boston engagement. But anyway, so Mahwah used to be immortalized in a Broadway show.
What rhymes with Mahwah? We don't know. So, Gerard.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, we interrupted you. So you came from Mahwah. Now what? How did you end up in theater?
I mean, after college, it's just something I always wanted to try, but didn't have sort of, I guess you would say, the courage to do it. And then after college, I was scouted by someone on the bus. And long story short, I got in with Ford Modeling Agency, had the opportunity to act. And then slowly but surely, after sort of tinkering around a little bit 7 years ago, I decided I wanted to pursue it, like, seriously, 100%. So, it was sort of a convoluted way, much more so than Morgan's. Getting into the acting field, but here I am.
Wow, that's great. And Morgan, how about you? You mentioned you're from Chicago and you have a mom
that
teaches.
Yeah, so where I'm from isn't quite as interesting as Gerard. I grew up in Arlington Heights, Illinois, about 20 minutes from Chicago. It's great. And at age 5 or 6, I think, I started doing shows. My first production was Annie. I was just in like the orphan cast. But my parents were both theater majors, so it's just kind of been something that I've wanted to do my whole life. And so I went to school for it, and then I moved here after college. So just been kind of a cut and dry case of loving acting.
Well, you know, I saw a production of Big in Arlington Heights, Illinois.
Oh.
Were you in that?
Oh, you did.
Yeah, were you in that?
I wasn't. No, I wish I was.
Okay. it's possible you would have been, because it was a while ago, and certainly there are kids in big, so it would have been possible. And that would have been a nice irony if I had seen you way back when.
I did lie. Yes, I was in it.
You were wonderful.
Thank you.
I totally went out. Where did you go to school?
I went to Illinois Wesleyan University.
And you studied theater or musical theater there?
Yeah, I got my BFA in musical theater there.
And how did you get from there to New York?
I think I blacked out and I moved here. I have no idea. I cannot remember what went through my mind, but I went to Oklahoma. I spent a summer there doing Oklahoma. And then I moved here. I don't know. I very bravely, because I knew no one. I had no job. I had no money. So kind of one of those NYC $3 two bags win me.
I was just going to say that.
you did Oklahoma in Oklahoma?
I did, in an outdoor theater at Discovery Land with real horses.
That wasn't by any chance. That wasn't the production with Kelly O'Hara and Will Chase, was it?
Yes.
Oh, no. Kelly O'Hara.
I would die if that was the production. love her. No, it was at the National Home of Rodgers and Hammerstein at Discovery Land.
Oh.
Yeah, that was my first out of college show that I did.
Wow. So that's great. So you have this thing, this Romeo and Juliet thing. Was it hard to get into the text there? Did you have some Shakespearean coaches that helped you guys through it? Or did it become natural to you?
Arbitha Spence, she was an assistant director at the Washington Shakespeare Company, Chris Henley, for 6 years. And then she's put on works of Shakespeare before in Washington. So she actually had a workshop session with all of the cast for about a month, and just working on everything from scansion to, working with the verse. And then from there, we watched about, I would say, how much, Morgan? About 100 hours of Bollywood films.
A lot of Bollywood. We watched Shakespeare too. I mean, we watched the Royal Shakespeare Company at the Globes production. We've been watching a lot of things. But yeah, we did have a lot of help with the text in the beginning, and then we just kind of worked it and worked it and worked it until it was just in our bodies, our brains, our mouths.
Well, we're very excited to have you on a Sunday morning. And as I will tell listeners that you can go to hypocritenyc.org, HYPOKRITNYC.org. And that link will be in the show notes and information about the show, which is February 6th to February 22nd at Axis Theater, 380 Broadway. So much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is awesome.
Absolutely.
See you at the show.
See you guys. Talk to you soon.
When you say Vegas, you're saying love. You're saying diamond rings and all the things that little girls dream of. You're hearing bells go ring, ding, ding for me and you. In Las Vegas, the land where dreams come true. When you say Vegas.
All right, well, let's move on to our reviews. The three of us got an opportunity to see Jason Robert Brown's new show, Honeymoon in Vegas. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
James, given the fact that you said the three of us saw it, I think we should hear your opinion first.
Why
should we do all the work?
I feel like I'm not objective with Honeymoon in Vegas or any Jason Robert Brown show, which is why I wanted to throw it to you guys first, because I loved it. But I love most things that Jason does. So
I saw your Facebook post, so I knew you loved it.
You did? Yes. So yeah. So Honeymoon in Vegas, the transfer from Paper Mill to the Broadway stage has been seamless. They even did some cutting and the show flew along for me. I loved it. I think that it's there for the taking. I think it's going to tour really well. I think that Tony Danza should go out on the tour, because the night that I saw it, the audience loved Tony Danza. Did he do that soft shoe tap number in Paper Mill, or was that new? Do you guys remember?
Is that even he tapping? I mean, there was something about it that seemed like I was hearing taps from off stage. It didn't seem to match what I seemed to be seeing his beat doing. I don't know. That's a terrible thing to say, and I'll retract that immediately. But but I don't remember that at Paper Mill necessarily. But of course, it's been a year and a half, and that means about 500 shows ago.
Yeah.
And it's hard to keep track. All right, James, we'll let you off the hook. This is a very good show for the tired businessman, that type of musical. It certainly has wonderfully pointed lyrics by Jason Robert Brown, and certainly the music is in the style of a show that would have the word Vegas in its title. The story involves a young man who is in love with a lady, but his mother made him promise that he would never get married because she was so possessive she wanted him all for herself, even after she died. So he's been stringing along Betsy for 5 years, and she's been patient. Bryn O'Malley does this very, very well, by the way. She's a lovely, lovely presence. And Rob McClure, who we know from Chaplin, is pinpoint perfect without a single flaw in his performance as this nebbishy guy who's having a tough time balancing all this. Well, finally, he agrees that they'll go to Las Vegas and get married, but he's still stalling a little bit, and he gets involved in a poker game, and that's where Tony Danza comes in. And Tony Danza is quite the card sharp, and certainly our hero will pay for this because he doesn't win the game, and now the card sharp does not have much interest in anything but Betsy because it reminds him of his dead wife. And there is a reference to Hitchcock in the show. I mean, because this is rather Vertigo-ish, and it's not quite a lovely compliment to a woman when she hears that the reason the guy loves her is because she reminds him of someone else. Nevertheless, it's a bright and breezy show. I think the first act flew by. I felt like I was there for 13 minutes. It really was tremendously well directed in that way. And great, great fun. Second act, not as quick. Okay. Gets a little too silly, but still a very enjoyable evening. Not a classic. The type of show that gets 7 Tony nominations struggles to win them, though I would give Rob McClure a good shot at winning the Tony since he's so good in what he's doing. I really don't see any semblance of a flaw in that performance. So the cast is really quite winning. What's really interesting to me is that seeing the show at Paper Mill, it was on a much wider stage, and it is so much smaller at the Nederlander. And I remember one time, I think it was Dennis Grimaldi, who was Ben Sprecher, I think it was, now that I think, but when Annie 2 closed in Washington, and then they decided to resuscitate it as Annie Warbucks, and they booked the now defunct, raised, in fact, a Variety Arts Theater on between 13th and 14th Street on the east side. He said, there's something wonderful about having a big show in a small space. And if you believe that, well, you'll certainly see that at the Nederlander Theater, which has a very nice new proscenium, which I'm not sure if it's part of the set or is a new proscenium. So if you haven't been to the Nederlander in a while, and certainly there's only been 2 shows there since 1996. So you may very well see a spunkier and more attractive proscenium. And better still, of course, what's inside that proscenium will give you some pleasure.
So, Michael, what did you think?
Well, I'm very much in agreement with Peter. I loved the show at Paper Mill. I just didn't know what to expect going in at Paper Mill. Of course, no one did. It sounded so interesting from the beginning because it was so different. It sounded like it would be so different in terms of style as compared to Jason Robert Brown's other shows. And indeed it is, but I think it's, among that type of pastiche score, I think it's really one of the best. I think it goes up there with the best of Candor and Ebb and other people who often write in that style. One great thing about it is that there are, of course, the numbers that are meant to actually be Vegas pastiches. David Josephsburg appears in Act 1 as this kind of sleazy lounge singer, and he has a couple of numbers. And then he turns up in Act Two as a leader of the Flying Elvis group. And both of those songs sound exactly as you as you would want them to sound, but and yet, you know, with some originality too, and just really, really catchy. But even the other songs, the book songs, to me sounded like all of a piece with the Vegas stuff somehow. They didn't sound, you know, in a, like they were in a completely different musical language, as, for example, some of the songs in Sideshow did. I think I mentioned that. So I think that's pretty great. In terms of the music itself, this could almost have been written in the 60s, and I mean that as a great compliment. But what one of the things that makes it different is that the lyrics are so clever. The lyrics are more postmodern and more knowing, I suppose, maybe more sarcastic sometimes than lyrics in the 60s would be. But as far as the score, I cannot wait for the cast album. I really, really looking forward to it. And I think, yes, I agree about Act One. I think Act Two, it's funny. I remember saying from the beginning, the one thing I specifically remember from the Paper Mill production is that I felt the first Elvis number went on too long. Great number. Fantastic choreography. I just think if it had been cut by, I don't know, about a third, and really the choreography by Dennis Jones is great, but it just seemed like it was went on a little too long, and I was disappointed that they didn't agree with me and cut that a little, because at that point in the story, I mean, the plot is really, you know, it's really moving forward, and you're getting to the denouement. You want to see what's going to happen, and so to spend that much time on it seemed a little odd. And another song that was not that well received on the night I went was the airport song, where they're trying to book Rob McClure's character onto a flight from Hawaii to Vegas, and apparently it's very difficult to do that. So they're giving him all these options. Well, you could go through, and it winds up he always would have to go through Atlanta, and he doesn't want to do that. So the song itself was fine, but it wasn't hysterically funny. And again, the night I went, the audience didn't really seem to respond to it that well.
Michael, I have an observation about that song, too, that I'd like to make. Yes. We live in an era now where, and this was certainly true of the kids in Atlanta, where when somebody holds a note for a long period of time, halfway through, and it's almost calibrated perfectly, people tend to start applauding and going, woo, because the note is being held. It's one of the things I like least about 21st century musical theater. Mm. However, it was very interesting at the night I went. This song has that, and to be fair, it's more motivated than it is in most situations, because the guy's hesitating, the airline clerk trying to find a flight for him. But it was so interesting to me that the audience was not applauding at the usual point where, as I say, halfway through, everybody knows this is the halfway point, and they applaud and go, woo. That didn't quite happen. And as time went on, a few seconds more, a few seconds after that, a few seconds after that, finally a few people applauded, almost as if they were embarrassed that there was no applause being given for this moment. But frankly, I'd like to know why people think that holding a note for an inordinate length of time is so amazing. I of course, it depends on the note. I'll grant you that. I mean, some notes that are astronomically high, okay. But it seems to me we're in a knee-jerk reaction era now where if somebody holds a note, you feel, not I, but I mean many audience members have been trained and feel compelled to applaud and go woo halfway through. So that's one of the nice benefits of going to the theater at a critic's performance, where the critics are there and they don't do that type of thing any more than they bring fried chicken to their seats either. So I feel very lucky. So whatever they say about critics, at least we're well behaved when we go to the theater.
Well, so holding a note is kind of the Whitney Houston effect.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know,
and American Idol, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, American Idol started doing it because it seemed to me, at least, I could be totally wrong here, is that it was popularized by Whitney Houston. But, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about the lyrics for Honeymoon in Vegas because I was thinking about something when I saw it the other night that Peter has mentioned in the past is that it has so many popular references to today with Jay-Z and Beyonce and things like that. You know, what are we going to think of this in 10 or 15 years? I go back and listen to Rent now, and Rent's got so many references to when it was first written, and you're like, oh,
ACG even.
Yeah.
Well, but I don't think that's a problem, James, because
I don't think it's a problem. I just think it's interesting. Yeah.
No, it is. Yeah. I mean, but those people are so famous that I imagine that even, 25, 30 years from now, people are going to know who Jay-Z and Beyonce are, even if they're not anywhere near as popular.
Yeah, but it just dates it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It does. And frankly, I was confused in the opening number because I was surprised to hear Beyonce mentioned along with a reference to double headers, which we don't have in baseball anymore. Not really. We have separate admission double headers, and I understand why we don't have double headers. It's not so much that the athletes don't want to play 18 innings. It has more to do with the fact that they need to do two separate admissions because the athletes get paid so much and the money has got to come from somewhere. Anyway, that's another story.
I don't know, Peter. We have two on Saturday and two on Wednesday. We have to buy two separate tickets.
Yes, that's fair. That's fair. But anyway, it was established once upon a time that baseball did have doubleheaders where you saw two games for the price of one. Mm. And so when I first heard the lyric of Paper Mill, and it comes earlier than the Beyonce lyric, I assumed this was a period piece. But once I heard Beyonce, which is meant to rhyme with fiance, it certainly made me realize, we're in the here and now. So anyway, a small nitpick I'll grant you because I think the lyrics are really, really good. Jason Robert Brown is excellent for character, and if you don't know his song Just One Step from the Songs from a New World album, I urge you to get that, which I think is one of the greatest pieces of special material and characterization that I have ever heard in 50 odd years of listening to show music. So I urge you to get in touch with that one if you don't know it, and if you do know it, listen to it again because it really is quite wonderful.
Another one thing in Act Two of Honeymoon in Vegas, a reference that seemed to me and someone else, and I don't know what you guys thought, it seemed like they may change it from what, maybe not performance to performance, but maybe, week to week or month to month, and it really was kind of a cheap joke, even though everybody laughed. The Robin Clark character, Jack, is trying to think of non-sexy things so he won't respond to this this Hawaiian woman who's trying to distract him, and he's saying all of these things that are going to keep him not aroused, and finally he blurts out Bruce Jenner. It was funny, really kind of cheap, but that's the kind of joke that doesn't seem like it might have that long of a shelf life.
Speaking of the Hawaiian lady and speaking of the couple that's pretending to be somebody else, it seems to me they betray the Tony Danza character. His name is Tommy Corman. They betray him for no motivation whatsoever. Did you feel that?
Yes, I did. That was very rushed. Where they meet, I suppose to think that they're meeting Jack face to face somehow makes them think, oh, that's the guy that we did this to, and that fills them with remorse, and they suddenly tell him. But I didn't quite get it.
It would have been better if indeed Tommy Corman had not paid them as much as he said he was going to. But the fact that we just saw him pay a substantial amount of money, was I wouldn't think they'd betray him after that. And all they had to do was have him say, "Yeah, you didn't do a job that was worth $10,000. I'm giving you $2,000," and then the betrayal would have made much more sense.
That's brilliant. I love that.
That is great.
That is great, Peter. I wanted to mention what Michael mentioned, what I wrote on Facebook, and I wrote, I couldn't love the show any more than I do. Rob McClure, get your tux ready for June. Everybody buy your damn tickets now. And each one of those sentences has a special meaning. I think Rob McClure, as Peter mentioned, is exactly perfect. And
yeah, he really is.
And
you know, we'll see what happens with the Tonys, because of course, so many times people get Tonys because they didn't get them before, when people felt they could have gotten them. And certainly McClure's performance in Chaplin was one that everybody admired. So he didn't take home the brass ring that time. And it's possible. The only thing is, we have a million musicals opening, 100 million musicals opening between now and the Tonys. So it's crazy for any of us to really say for sure, you know, that anybody's going to get a nomination, because it's just too wide open a field right now. And this is not a criticism in any way of Rob McClure's worthiness for the Tony. Yes, indeed. Mm. I'd be very pleased if he won it, I think. But we'll see what happens between now and the end of April.
I did want to say, as much as I love this show, there's something about it that really pissed me off. And I'm wondering if either of you noticed this. I can't even remember what theater it was supposed to go into. Do either of you?
The Atkinson.
The Atkinson. Well, I don't suppose this would have made much of a difference, because there is a big problem with this show in that they have built a stage basically over the orchestra pit. And not only did they do that, but they play a lot of the action down there. And I had heard and read complaints from people sitting in the mezzanine that they could not see when the action was being played right down front. And I'm telling you, there's a lot of it down there. And you could certainly understand why people would have to lean over. I mean, I was not in the mezzanine, and I almost wanted to go up and see what it was like. But I would think that it would require people to lean over in order to try to see what's happening way down on that lip, which was never meant to be there. I mean, the theater was not designed for what happens in that space to be visible. So that's from the mezzanine, where I was not sitting. Now, in the orchestra, the way that thing juts out, it's so close to you and so high that I would say the worst seat I've ever had for any Broadway show. I was in the second row on house right, and I was the third and fourth seats in. And I was basically looking, you know, had my neck back looking up. I would think it would be even worse for the people in the center, because of the angle would be even worse for them. So I don't know if they had any, you know, if they just threw up their hands and said, well, this is our design and we can't do anything about it. But it really amazes me that sometimes directors think that that's not important for everybody to be able to see everything. It shouldn't only be for the people in the expensive seats.
Well, for that matter, the mezzanines are expensive seats. sometimes they're exactly the same price.
Yes.
I had a friend who came up from Boston this weekend who had been in love with the cast album like crazy and couldn't wait to see it. He had number 14. So that's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. He said they really should have said that was an obstructed view seat from where he was. And I believe that. In fact, he even asked, because, you know, he's no stranger to seating in theaters, and said, 14, will I be able to see it? Oh, yeah, you're fine. No, 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 don't worry, you know. And so he was rather furious that he was lied to. Go ahead.
No, I guess I was in 5 and 7. And but you know, if I had been in 5 and 7 and had been back several rows, it would have actually been much better. But it just seems to me, if you go to see this, don't sit up front in the orchestra. And I can't really vouch for the mezz, except that I've heard that people are having problems there too. I'm really sorry about that. I mean, that something like that should be such a negative on such a basically wonderful show. It's too bad they didn't have any other option.
One of the reasons they may have done it is because the orchestra is on stage in that famous band tradition, so that takes up a lot of real estate. So that's part of it.
If they had not built the lip, maybe the stage would not have been deep enough, which is basically what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you guys have you heard anything if Jason has conducted any of the shows?
Oh no, I haven't. But God knows he has that skill.
No.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I wonder if he'll give the conductor a few days off and do that. I know he conducted a few of Bridges of Madison County shows.
Mm, that's right.
And he's obviously cowboy. What was the cowboy thing?
Urban
cowboy. Where that was the actual role he was hired for was to do that.
That's right.
I did want to give a tip of the hat to Nancy Opel, who.
Oh yeah.
I did not see her as Evita back in the day, but I seem to remember hearing her sing at that time, and she sounds the same. I mean, she what a voice she's got, and she doesn't get too much opportunity to like really show it off, because she plays Jack's mother, and you know she's supposed to be like an old dying lady or dead, but there are a few moments when you think, wow, yeah, that's Evita.
So getting back to my Facebook post, is that everyone buy your damn tickets now, because I'm concerned because the numbers aren't great for the show, even after they got very good notices last week. So hopefully it's just a matter of January on Broadway type of thing. And come March, they have enough money in the budget to keep running. And
Let's make an editorial comment as well as a public service announcement, because Playbill had an offer for a 40% discount on seats that goes through May 31st. Now, that does indicate that this is a show that doesn't feel that it's going to sell out like crazy between now and then, even with quite a nice review from the New York Times. Mm. Again, we have learned over the years that the New York Times rave does not mean what it used to mean because of the internet and everybody coming out with so many opinions. The critical influence has certainly waned. But to offer a 40% discount through May 31st is pretty interesting, because really, you know, the next few weeks, that's one thing, you know, how many shows have had January and February sales, but May 31st? Anyway, may I point out to our listeners that indeed, go to playbill.com, take them up on this offer. You know, why not see it for less money than you have to pay? God knows theater tickets are too expensive to begin with. So keep your losses to a minimum in terms of that. And the way it always happens, you know, you have a better time when you pay less money. You just do. You just do. So.
And the last thing I want to say before we move on is that I think I've expressed how much I love the show and love Jason, and that everybody should go see this. I think that the weakest link is Tony Danza, and that I was playing fantasy casting in my head. I'm trying to figure out who should be in that role when Tony Danza leaves and takes it on a national tour, because he should go on a national tour and sell it at every single theater across the United States and make it a big hit there. But who should stay in the Broadway company when Tony Danza goes?
Well, I'm terrible at casting. Yeah. But I'm gonna go and endorse Tony Danza in this role. I didn't think weak link probably, but I thought he was fine in the part, and I thought he crooned very nicely the type of song that he had to croon. Mm-hmm. So I won't say that Tony Danza is a star, but I will say that he is a name. There is a difference between the two.
Sure.
As I think I said when we talked about the show at Paper Mill, I had seen Tony do a cabaret act some years ago, and while he was fantastic in terms of energy and charisma and all that stuff, the actual singing was really quite poor, and it had improved vastly by the time of Honeymoon at Paper Mill, and now I think it's even better. So I give so many props to him, because I think, you know, for someone, he obviously has really, really worked on it, and you know, he's not a young man anymore. To work at that age to develop your voice and improve it so much, I think that shows real dedication. And I also think he's perfect for the part. But James, just for what it's worth, how about Alec Baldwin in the part?
Oh yeah. As long as he can, you know, he seems to have a lot of outbursts recently. So I'm going to go see Jason at Subculture tomorrow night. So I'll report him on that next week. So Peter, when you were away last week, Michael and I talked about Constellations. You got a chance to see it. What did you think about it?
Well, this is the type of play that when you walk into the theater and you know that it's 70 minutes long, you feel a bit cheated already that you're going to be out in an hour. And then 10 minutes into this play, you're very grateful that it's going to be 70 minutes long. And in fact, you can't believe that 70 minutes can take so long. It's this play about alternative universes. And under those circumstances, we have a lot of repeated dialogue that then goes in different directions, one scene after another, that type of thing. A bell rings and they start the conversation over again, and then it goes slightly different, a few sentences different, and then the bell rings and they start all over again and the lights change and all that. And I understand the point of it, that of alternative universes and how a certain remark could lead us in a different direction and all that, but I found it very wearying. And a big hit, of course, because everybody wants to see Jake and Ruth, but you know, I don't think it's going to please very many people.
It's interesting that you say that, because Michael and I had exactly opposite opinions last week. Michael loved it, and I hated it. And
yeah.
I pretty much went not as elegantly as you just put it, but I, now that you have said that, that's, you know, it felt the same way for me, and that I'm very surprised at the stellar reviews that it got. And then Mr. Riedel this week has talked about how they are the people to beat in the Tony Awards.
Well, in a sense, they would deserve them from the vantage point that this must be such a murderously hard show to learn. Because, good Lord, I mean, given the fact that you have to go in different directions with dialogue you've just said, my heart goes out to them. So really, they did not make it easy for themselves in making their Broadway debuts. There would have been many other vehicles in which they would have had an easier time of it. And they, even though it's only 70 minutes, they must be as exhausted as we are in the audience when they finish the show. So really, a lot of credit has to be given to them for sticking it out and doing as well as they can under extraordinarily difficult circumstances.
You also got a chance to see Nevermore. Why don't you tell us about that?
Nevermore is going to be one of the most controversial shows of the year. Five people walked out during the first act, and at the end of the first act, I would dare say that 40 people walked out, and including the person I was with. And at the end of the show, however, there were about 40 people who stood up and cheered like crazy. And one can easily say, they didn't pay. They're investors. Maybe. But it seemed to me that it was really heartfelt. You either love or hate this show. It's about Edgar Allan Poe. And my problem, one of the many problems I have with it, is that Jordan Christensen, who wrote it, wrote the book, wrote the music, wrote the lyrics, and directed, never a good sign, because this may not be the case, but the implication is it happened that way because nobody wanted to work with them. But the real problem for me is that there's a chorus of people who keep speaking in rhymed couplets describing Edgar Allan Poe's life. So there's very little drama that is shown. One of the great rules of drama, of course, is show, don't tell. Well, there's all telling in this one. It's mostly telling. It's very steampunk, very goth, very grand guignol, and gory stories without the whimsical humor at all. There's very little humor in it. And frankly, there's very little in the terms of songs. There's a lot of music, but it seems to be background music that's played as people are speaking these rhymed couplets. Every now and then, I don't think it's more than five times, I may be wrong, people actually sing what is known as a song, but it doesn't happen often. The costumes are very fanciful. They don't really make sense on a logical level. But again, they're not looking for that. I will say this director certainly knew what he wanted. He definitely has on stage the vision that he had for this show. And in that way, it's very successful. It's very slick in the sense of panels moving and people being in the right place at the right time. All that stuff is in place. But I found it one of the hardest shows to sit through in a long, long time. And I wish I could say I was one of the Bravo leaders, but I certainly was not. And I was really counting the minutes until the damn thing could be over. It really has the potential to be one of those legendary off-Broadway disasters. And there aren't that many of them, because the thing is, to be a real disaster, you have to have size, and size means Broadway. There are about 10 people in the show, and that's kind of big for an off-Broadway musical these days. But when you're an off-Broadway musical, you're automatically not that big a show, and therefore you're not that big a disaster. But this one has the potential to be, and yet I am not predicting for a tenth of a second that it's going to close next weekend. By no means. Those fans really were into it. So if you're into it, you will have a good time. But I won't be surprised if most of you feel the way I did, that it was interminable and the toughest show to sit through in a long, long time.
All right. So let's clean up a few messes that we have here. We had a Bill Nye incident that all of you have emailed all of us. I think everybody on the internet told us we were wrong. So, Michael, can you explain it? Because I was very confused.
Well, it was my fault. I confused the wonderful actor Bill Nye, N-I-G-H-Y, who has appeared in such films as Love Actually, Pirates of the Caribbean, two Pirates of the Caribbean movies, the Underworld film series, and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. I confused him because of a conversation I had had with someone else. I thought he was the same person as Bill Nye, NYE, the science guy, who I really, although he apparently is extremely popular, I obviously don't know who he is because I thought it was the same person. So maybe James can tell us a little bit about Bill Nye, the science guy.
Well, Bill Nye, the science guy, has got a television show and where he talks about science, and he's really famous in the geek community, but being on Broadway probably not his bag of tricks, and that's why I was so surprised, because he was at a show. I don't know what show he was at. I think he went to go see Gentleman's Guide, and he went backstage and talked to everybody after that, and had mentioned his affinity for Broadway. So I was thinking, wow, is he lined something up very quickly. Also, on the cleanup scale, it seems as though that the incoming musical Neverland is interviewing for press reps. Isn't that true, Michael?
Yeah.
Very interesting to see who's going to take it on. Yeah. As I understand, there may be, in case you don't know what we're talking about, Harvey Weinstein, who has been known as a stern taskmaster, especially on this project, for which Jeremy Jordan and Michael McGraw have no longer jobs as a result of his meddling in it. But he is the producer, I mean, you know. But he seems to be a very exacting guy, and it's been reported that Rick Miramontes, who is easily one of our leading press agents, who has really made his company come up in the world like crazy. Anyway, they had a difference of opinion, let's say, and Rick excused himself from the project, though I hear that they may get back together again. But if they don't, it's going to be very interesting to see who winds up as the press agent on Finding Neverland.
It was reported as, at least in some places, is that he was quote unquote fired. Now, who knows exactly who said
sure,
it first?
Sure, yeah.
But did you read the quote? People said it was like maybe the greatest quote in the history of press agentdom, although it's not usually directed against the producer.
Sure.
But the quote was, Broadway to Harvey Weinstein, drop dead.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Well, you know, Harvey has a reputation similar to Scott Rudin, that they're very demanding people. And they, you know, Scott Rudin's assistant, although he has got a number of assistants, he never seems to run out of them, and people, you know, come and go in that job very, very quickly. And he never seemed to run out of somebody who's willing to step up and be Scott Rudin's assistant. I'm assuming that, you know, assuming somebody's going to step up and say,
Oh, I am sure there are many press agents who applied for the job after they heard this was happening. It's just a simple case of whether or not the people who apply, whoever wins the job, so to speak, and maybe we should put quotation marks around the word wins, whoever gets the job, how long they'll keep it, or if they'll ever regret taking it on and saying Rick was right. It's entirely possible that that will be the motivation as time goes on. But it makes for interesting press, no question. And we are interested to see what's going to happen here. And boy, though, you know, with these firings and with this, you know, boy, when the lights go down, when we go to see Finding Neverland, it's really going to be there's so much attached to it that when it's going to be hard to divorce all that goes with it, you know, from the show itself. So and sometimes that does work out. You know, sometimes people say, well, you know, despite all the controversy, it turned out to be a good show. And who knows? You know, I mean, the famous stories about David Merrick, the greatest producer of the 50s and 60s. The statements were made, yes, he was terrible. He was hard. But he got my best work out of me because he was so difficult. Maybe that's what's going to happen here.
Well, another interesting thing will be that maybe this was just a ploy, but Weinstein did float the idea that maybe we'll do the press in-house. And if that happens, that's going to be not completely unprecedented, but almost, for a Broadway show to not have a, you know, a Broadway press agent. Didn't we see it recently with one or more of those sports plays?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but that almost never happens, and that would get the ATPAM, which is the press agents union, that would get them against the show, and really could become very, very interesting.
By the way, I don't want to hear a bad word about Scott Rudin because he asked for an advanced copy of my book and he liked it. So I mean that.
Okay, I think that wraps it up for this week. In a minute, we're going to give you the answers to the previous week's trivia questions as well as a new trivia question. But before we do that, I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your Android device. That way, This Week on Broadway will be automatically streamed to you. Broadway World Radio also plays this Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, I think we have a hit with our trivia questions. Although one of the big cries from the chorus is that we have to give the answers. There actually are no answers to these things. We've been just playing with everybody.
That's right. So
Peter, do you remember them? Can we go through them?
Well, I did ask about the identity of a man who appeared in two movie versions of 50s Broadway musicals. I don't mean he was in 50 shows. His appearance in the first necessitated a retooling and retitling. In the second, he had a mere uncredited cameo. In the 60s, he appeared in a film version of a 50s hit that had run close to a year, although his participation in the film automatically vulgarized the character that had been in the play. That he was starring in a big musical in the 70s almost caused a piece of New York real estate to be named for him until the show closed in Boston. Broadway didn't hear from him again until the 90s, although it may yet hear from him again. Who is he? He's Jerry Lewis. Let me explain. The two movie versions of the 50s musicals, his appearance in the first necessitated retooling and retitling because that was Hazel Flagg, which we're going to see in musicals tonight in March. Hazel Flagg was a Julie Stein musical, but when they bought it for Hollywood, they changed it to Homer Flagg, and Jerry Lewis played the part, and Dean Martin was in it too when they were still partners, and it was called Living It Up. The uncredited cameo, he's actually in the movie of Little Abner, so watch for him there. He shows up just for a second, but he's there. In the 60s, he appeared in a film version of a 50s hit. That was Visit to a Small Planet, and it was a very different characterization because Cyril Richard played it in the on Broadway. Now, there's profound difference between Jerry Lewis's type of humor and Cyril Richard's dry martini humor. So that's why I say it was vulgarized. The big musical in the 70s was Hell's a Poppin', and the piece of real estate that was supposed to be named for him when Hell's a Poppin' came in was the Jerry Lewis Arcade. When you go to see The Lion King and you go through that tunnel-y type thing,
That was supposed to be called the Jerry Lewis Arcade, but with the show not coming in from Boston, that was the end of that. Broadway didn't hear from him until the 90s. Yeah, that's when he did Damn Yankees, although it may yet hear from him again. Remember The Nutty Professor with music by Marvin Hamlisch was a show that played at least in Tennessee, and if we live long enough, we may get to see it. So that's the answer to that one. I also asked that there was a composer who had two musicals that opened with songs that did not actually have the name of the song in the title. And that's Meredith Willson, whose first show, The Music Man, Rock Island, opens the show. You do not hear the words Rock Island. The second show was The Unsinkable Molly Brown. I Ain't Down Yet, a great song, by the way, but nobody ever sings I Ain't Down Yet in that song. Yes, in the finale they do, but in the actual song, when people are really singing, you do not hear the words I Ain't Down Yet. So that was the answer to that one. The answer to the one about which play was the first one to charge $10 for a ticket, it wasn't a Broadway show. It was an off-Broadway show. It was The Boys and the Band in 1968 at Theater 4, which just was torn down a few months ago on 55th Street. Why a theater on 55th Street should be called Theater 4 and not Theater 55 is another issue. But anyway, The Boys and the Band, the famous play by Mark Crowley that helped the gay movement to pick up steam, was the first one to actually went to $10 when Broadway plays were charging about $7.50. So that was a big thing in those days. So those are the answers to those trivia questions.
Well, that's great. And so we have another trivia question for this week.
All right. There's a famous Tony-winning songwriting team, and they were working on a musical that never was produced. But the name of that musical was also the name of a Broadway theater for a brief period of time. So, just to give you an example, what I mean is something like Rodgers and Hammerstein were working on a musical called Coronet, because there was a Coronet theater that's, I believe, now the O'Neill. So that's the type that I'm looking for. I'm looking for the composer, lyricist, very famous team, wrote a hit that is still being performed all over the world. They were working on a show, never happened, but it had the name of a theater that's now currently operating, but under a different name. So that's a real brain teaser. We'll see what happens there.
All right. So if you do have the answers for those things, please go to our show page at BroadwayRadio.com, and there's contact information for Peter, Michael, and me, and send us your answers. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.